is not just not popping out the babies. And so Isaac goes to God and he prays on her behalf. And it says that God opens Rebecca's womb and she gets pregnant. And the text indicates that that she has twins and that they're struggling within her. And so she goes and asks God. She's like, God, what's going on? One commentator says that she goes and asks God what's going on because she was, quote, weary of the intestine tumult, which I thought was very interesting. Toria was recently pregnant. Maybe she can testify to the intestine tumult that happens when you're pregnant. She goes and she inquires of God, and she's like, what's going on? And she gets this really weird prophecy. She's like, I just want to know why my acid reflux is acting up, but instead I get this super weird prophecy. So the prophecy says that she has two nations in her womb, and that one will be stronger than the other, and that the older will serve the younger. And so she gives birth to them, and we find out that Esau is hairy and red. Now, I don't know about you, but I really wouldn't want my identifier to be that I'm hairy and red. That's a little weird. It doesn't really give it much of a description of Jacob. But it does say that he comes out grasping the heel of Esau. And the name Jacob is said to mean grasper of the heel, but also supplanter. And the very next thing that we learn in the text is like years later. So Esau does indeed grow up to be a pretty manly man after all. He's a hunter and an outdoorsman, and we find that Isaac favors him. We also learn that Jacob is a quiet man who dwells among the tents. And so one of the Midrash is like the Jewish interpretation and commentaries on Jewish texts, indicates that he was a holy man. And it specifically said that he studied the Torah, but that doesn't make any sense considering that this is in the Torah, so not really sure about that Midrash. And it says that he was a holy man, he spent time in his tent, and he honored God, according to Midrash. But the Bible specifically says that Rebecca favors him. So we already have some weird sibling rivalry stuff going on. So the next scene is where Esau sells his birthright to Jacob, and this is chapter 25. We jump down to 27. And so we have Esau, he goes out into the field and he hunts, and he comes back from a long day and he's exhausted, and Jacob is cooking stew, probably more specifically like a lentil stew. And I did read one commentary that this was probably in response to Abraham recently dying, because that's what you cook lentil stew when someone dies. So Esau says, give me some of that stew. And Jacob says, first, sell me your birthright. And I read a commentary that this is probably a conversation that has happened several times before. It's not just Jacob pulling this weird deception out of his back pocket. They've probably discussed this, and Jacob has probably seen that he wants the birthright. And they probably also know about this prophecy that Rebecca received. So Esau agrees to sell his birthright. He says, what good is my birthright to me if I'm dead? And then the text says that he sells it, and Jacob is like, I need you to promise that I actually have this birthright. And Esau does, and it says, and so he despised his birthright. And so a lot of people believe, by people I mean Bible scholars that are much more qualified to be interpreting than I am, it says Esau's actions show that he really doesn't understand the gravity of his position, that he would be willing to sell his lineage and his inheritance for a bowl of soup was a really grave thing. One commentary even said that if Esau was truly starving, it would have been better for him to have died under the blessing of his birthright than to die in a curse of starvation and sell his birthright. Not a good move on Esau's part. It really kind of supports this idea that Jacob knew that Esau wasn't going to be able to be a good leader, which is why he, he bought the birthright. Esau then, we find out, so we're going to jump over, to the end of chapter 26, where Esau has wives. And the text says, when Esau was 40 years old, he took as his wife Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Besema, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. So this, once again, probably supports the idea that Esau had no regard for his family and God's covenant with them, and therefore was not fit to be their leader. The Hittites were under the curse of Noah, and they also had many many, many gods, which would have been a huge slap in the face to this very monotheistic family. So, and then next, we jump over to the big trickery here. Well, the second trickery, really, which is in chapter 27, the stolen blessing. So we have the birthright, which is about inheritance, and then we have the blessing, which is about more like spiritual blessing. Would you agree with that, Jay?
Yeah, and the promise of the future covenant that's already in this line is included in that, I would say.
Yeah. So Isaac is old, and he wants to give a blessing to Esau. Rebekah overhears and plots with Jacob for him to get the blessing. So Jacob goes to his father pretending to be Esau, and he receives the blessing. And then Esau, like just like a drama, Esau comes in ready to get the blessing. He's like, hey, Dad, I've got you some of that food you like. And the jig is up. And the text specifically says that Isaac trembled uncontrollably. I'm over in verse 33. Lots happen. We've had a lot of stuff happen. So in verse 33 of chapter 27, it says, Isaac began to tremble uncontrollably. Who was it then, he said, who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it all before you came in, and I blessed him. Indeed, he will be blessed. So I've never heard this before, and Jay and Mitchell had never heard this before, so we thought we should talk about this. So I read several places, actually. So I originally only read it in one commentary, and then I found it in, like, two other commentaries, that Isaac is trembling uncontrollably because he has gone against God, and God is rebuking him. So Isaac probably has heard this prophecy from Rebekah that Jacob would rule over Esau. So why did he clearly favor Esau? And not only do we see him just favoring Esau, we see him favoring Esau even after he sells his birthright and marries two Hittite women. And Isaac is still willing to give this blessing to him. So some believe that he trembles because he's realizing that God is thwarting Isaac's plan to thwart God's plan. We've got a lot of thwarting of plans here. So Isaac is saying, yeah, God, these several commentaries propose that Isaac is saying, yeah, God, I know you have this plan, but I like mine better. So I'm going to enact my plan. And God's like, whoa, hold the phone, Isaac, not happening. So we have numerous deceptions in this story. Isaac trying to deceive God and his plans, Rebekah deceiving Isaac and Esau, Jacob deceiving Isaac and Esau. But despite all of these deceptions and plotting, God's plan still prevails. And I think that's the point of this story, is that God comes into our messiness and he makes things right. Also, shout out to Esau. I think he takes the big L in this story, because though he is a big doof, he is apparently very sorrowful. It mentions several times in the middle part of chapter 27 that he cries out with a loud and bitter cry. And he says, bless me too, Father. And then it says again in verse 38, Isaac wept loudly. And so also, you know, he's alienated from his father. He's alienated from his mother and his brother. Poor guy only has his Hittite wives at this point. I think the big L in the story goes to Esau.
It's also interesting that in all of this deception, all of this thwarting that's going on, none of it is ever condemned. There's kind of a stew in your own juices. This is the bed you made, so you sleep in it. But Isaac isn't ever rebuked. Jacob isn't rebuked. Rebekah isn't rebuked. No one is rebuked for their deception. We'll see later Laban, when he deceives Jacob, he's not rebuked. So it's kind of all part and parcel of this. It's kind of an interesting thing that, even though there's lying on a mass scale here, you know, I mean, think of it this way. If you have a will today, we have special protections against this kind of thing happening, what Jacob is doing here. Like, if you have undue influence in the signing of a will, you can't inherit under the will. But here it's just part of what they do, apparently. Think of how bad it is. Deception is bad, right? We can all agree on that. And deception of your parent or loved one is maybe a little bit worse. And deception of a blind parent is maybe worse than that. You know, maybe one that's going senile. You know, there's some pretty awful stuff going on here within the family, this family politics. But it's, none of it is actually ever condemned here in Genesis. Just an interesting point that is not what they're worried about, whoever actually wrote this, whether it's Moses or someone else editing it later, that they're not concerned about the deception. They're concerned about the blessing continuing on through this family. So,
yeah. And Jay has mentioned before that this is really a commentary of how we are getting to Egypt, right? And that I think that like even kind of supports that claim that there's no like moral commentary on it. It's just this is how we got here. So,
All right. We're gonna if there isn't anything else you guys want to say here, we'll move on to Jacob's ladder and God communicating the blessing. That's true. It is close to the beginning, and they can't all be learning, certainly. Yeah.
We don't have Ten Commandments at this point.
Right. Yeah, she's exactly right. We don't have Ten Commandments. We don't have the development of the law. We have a bunch of people trying to get by. You know, that's exactly right. All right. So you guys all know what happens next in the story is that Esau's mad, Isaac's mad, and Rebecca says... Here, I can stand up now that I'm talking again. And Rebecca says, I need to send Jacob away. Jacob needs to get out of here. And so she sends him to her brother, Laban, back up in kind of the northern part of Mesopotamia. And on the way there, he stops and he has a dream at Bethel. And we call that Jacob's ladder or Jacob's stairway. I just want to comment briefly on the translation between the two. Modern scholars prefer a stairway over a ladder for two reasons. One is because of the comparison to the ziggurat in Babylon, and one is because it's hard to imagine a ladder with people going up and down at the same time. It actually doesn't really matter. I would just say that Led Zeppelin preferred Stairway to Heaven. It's a better lyric than Ladder to Heaven. But it just doesn't work the same. But the KJV is the one that introduced the ladder to heaven. And so that's the one that we kind of time honor and call it Jacob's ladder because of that. But the point here is he has this vision, and God appears to him, and he says, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac. And he makes the same promise that he made to Abraham and to Isaac, that you're going to have land and you're going to have descendants numerous. He specifically here says, that the descendants will be as numerous as the dust of the land or something to that effect. And it's interesting because before we've had sand on the seashore, we've had stars in the heavens, and this time we're having dust. And some people look at this and go, well, why is the word dust here? We've got the comparison to, you know, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And so that could be one reason is we're just being reminded of that. But some other people say, we're seeing a prediction of Israel's future and the nature of their relationships with countries to come, that they will be trod on by other nations, by the Egyptians, by the Babylonians, by the Assyrians, by Germany, you know, whoever else that you want to put into that, that we will have this, that they will be treated as dust and trampled upon by other people, even though they are a blessing to all of those other people. So that's just kind of an interesting point there. And then we move to Laban's household and his daughters that become Jacob's wives. I just want to say a quick note about Laban first. Most people think that Laban was not from a wealthy family. He was not a wealthy man himself. If you look both with Isaac and with Jacob, he gives his sister and his daughters away basically to the first person we know of that asked for them, which means that he hadn't had other better economic offers at that point in time. Laban, for instance, when Eliezer, the servant, comes to on behalf of Isaac, he's only hospitable to Eliezer after he receives the gifts that Eliezer brings. Before that, he's kind of non-committal about him. Laban has no recorded sons either. We're not told of any, though we do know that he has family. That means he needs to pay people to tend to his flocks, and that's a drain on the family. It also explains why Rebecca is noted to be a shepherdess, because she's out there in the field working as well. And he also gets 14 free years of labor out of Jacob for his two daughters, and that's a big boon at that point in time in that economic system. So you have, I'm going to say, two sets of wives. You have Leah and Rachel, and then you have the handmaidens, Zilpah and Bilhah, which are just awful names. Never name your children that. When Jacob meets Rachel, he urges the shepherds that are there to water their flocks and be on their way. And to the point that he's like, well, I'm just going to move this stone out myself. I just wonder if he's trying to get some alone time with Rachel, who happens to be there. He's like, she's pretty, I'd like to talk with her, but there are all these other shepherds around, we need to get him out.
That's my vote, so.
So Rachel is not a fortuitous event, though. She doesn't just appear out of nowhere. This is kind of an indication of God's guidance on the family and God's plan for the family. So then Jacob goes over to Laban. He makes a generous offer. Compared to the other prices that we see recorded in these ancient tablets and stuff, 7 years of labor is a really good deal for a wife. As little as 20 silver pieces silver talents or whatever, but 7 years of hard labor is really a good price. And then so, of course, we all know the story that he shows up for his wedding after 7 years, and lo and behold, it's Leah rather than Rachel. And you notice, I said, there is no qualm about Laban having done this, and Jacob doesn't complain about it either. He doesn't say, Laban, this is totally unfair. This isn't what we agreed to. He's kind of like, well, I'm a tricker, and I've deceived, and I just got what I deserved. You know, maybe is kind of the way he's thinking about it, but he's not upset about it at all, except to say that, well, fine, I'll work another 7 years, and you can give me Rachel, except that if you notice from the text, Leah and Rachel are both married to Jacob within about a week. Like, he doesn't have to wait the whole 7 years for the second wife. So we get to read what Leah names her children out of this. And you can see just how hurt she is. She says, with her first son, Reuben, surely my husband will love me now. With her second son, Simeon, because I am not loved, God gave me this one too. With her third son, Levi, now at last my husband will become attached to me. And then finally, with her fourth son, I think this is an interesting shift. We don't have a complaint about her relationship with Jacob, but we have her saying with Judah, this time I will praise the Lord. Like she's, and so I look back at the curse from that we had back in Genesis 2?
3.
Or 3? 3, yeah, the fall. The woman's desire will be for her husband. And here we have a perfect example of an unloved woman desiring for her husband, and the shift that she goes through, I think, is very poignant in that she decides my desire shouldn't be for my husband. It should be for God. I should praise God for this, not worry about my relationship with my husband.
I also think it's interesting that this is Judah, right? That, like, you know, he's like, I will praise the Lord. This is also the line from which David and Jesus come. So it's like God blesses that she is finally praising him. Yeah.
Yeah. The kingship does come from Judah. And the priesthood comes from Levi, the third son. Rachel, of course, then, in addition to Leah's sons, Leah has two more sons. She says about Zebulun, that this is her sixth son, that my husband will finally give me honor. So she's back to her old tricks there, I guess. And Rachel, of course, ends up with Joseph and Benjamin. She dies giving birth to Benjamin, as you may recall. With Bilhah and Zilpah, the second set of wives, the handmaidens, it was tradition that a father would give his daughters maidservants when they're married, at least one. And Laban follows that tradition. He gives one to Leah and one to Rachel. It's also tradition that a barren wife would give a maidservant to the husband as a proxy. Like, I can't have children, so therefore this woman is going to have children on my behalf. The maidservant was given the honor and became a kind of a second status wife. She wasn't like the main wife, but she was also a wife. So you had that political aspect of it between in that relationship. But the children were considered to be the children of the barren woman as well. They were, I don't want to say the property, but definitely the within the custody of the barren woman. So we had that with Sarah earlier, and now we're having it with Rachel as well. So there's that. After 14 years of work, Jacob then negotiates with Laban for his own sheep. He says, give me the imperfect ones and I'll take care of them like they're my own. And so he works for about another seven years there. And he's got this huge increase in the number of sheep that he gets. And then gets to the point where things don't seem to be going so well with Laban anymore, because Laban is getting jealous and his family is getting jealous. And so Jacob takes his family and flocks in the middle of the night and runs off. It mentions that Rachel takes the household idols. In this culture, those household idols or household gods were the indicator of the birthright. So whoever inherited the idols had control of the family and had control of that family's property. That's probably why Laban was so upset, was because it showed that he was no longer the possessor of that property. What's more interesting about this is this episode shows the contempt that the Israelite had for idols, that a menstruating woman would sit on them. Once we get to the law in a couple of weeks, we'll see that menstruation was extremely unclean. It's the same reason that Jesus being touched by the bleeding woman was so shocking to New Testament readers. This was just, if you were touched by blood at all, that was bad. But for whatever reason, menstruating women were considered like the worst. And so that she's sitting on these idols, it shows just such disrespect for these idols. That's probably why this was there. But it also shows that Rachel was just as deceptive as the whole family she was marrying into, that she was willing to do this.
I also think that it really shows her buy-in to this promise, right? That she's willing to be like, to symbolically be like, we have the birthright and the inheritance because we're the best because God said so.
So then Laban, of course, catches up, ends up giving Jacob a blessing and saying, all right, let's have a pact between us, and they go off in peace. And so then we have the reunion of Jacob and Esau. And I have an episode of Game of Thrones here, because this is exactly what Jacob is expecting when he's going back to Canaan. He is prepared for a bloodbath. He's ready for the absolute worst. He ends up dividing his entourage, his family, into two. The reason for that is he finds out that Esau has 400 men and that he's coming out to meet him. And he thinks, 400 men? I don't have 400 men. Man, he's going to slaughter me. I better split my family in two. And that way, if there's a group over here and a group over there, whichever one he attacks, the other one can get away.
Very utilitarian.
Yeah, very utilitarian. He also prepares gifts for Esau with space between each group so that they're supposed to meet however far apart. And the idea behind that, I read something, is that this was a common military tactic, apparently, so that word could get back that if the first group was attacked, someone might be able to run off and warn the next group, and then it could get back to Jacob that, you know, he wasn't safe. He's so paranoid about this that he sends everything on ahead of him, and he spends the night alone there on the bank of the Jabbok River. And this is where we have the wrestling with God episode. The man comes in the middle of the night and wrestles with him. Neither one could be overpowered, neither the man nor Jacob. And so the man touches Jacob's hip, and there's this little thing in here that this is a teaching story about why they don't eat certain cuts of meat from a hip on animals. But I think it also shows more of the nature of Jacob. We saw earlier that he required Esau's promise when Esau sold his birthright. We also have Jacob requiring a blessing to release his hold on this man. He says, I'm not going to let go until you bless me. And then so the man says, fine, I'll bless you, but what's your name? Like, I don't even know who you are. And Jacob says that, you know, I'm Jacob. And the man says, well, your name is no longer Jacob, but Israel. You've struggled with God. Israel means to struggle or to contend with God. And that's the only reason that we know that the man is God, because the name implies it. He doesn't actually disclose his name. Remember, we talked last week about the name being power, and we mentioned the possibility that God is a title and Yahweh is possibly not really a name, and so do we actually have a name for God? We have here again the God being not giving a name, just saying, well, here's your name then. And then to finish our Game of Thrones analogy, the next story that we have is Dinah being raped by the Shechemite or Shechemite or however you want to say it. Simeon and Levi, as a matter of revenge, say, all right, fine, you want to marry her now that you've already raped her. Why don't you guys all go ahead and get circumcised, you and your entire city? So all of these guys, 3 days later, get circumcised. And they're like, great, the marriage can proceed. And then Simeon and Levi go in and kill everyone anyway. So it's very much this bloodbath that we've had. It fits right in with the Game of Thrones episode. And that's kind of the end of Jacob and Esau until we have the birth of Joseph.
Yeah, so so we're in chapter 34 with Dinah being defiled. And then we're going to jump, I think, where is it, 37? Yeah, 37. All right, so flip with me over to 37. Also, I gave Esau the big L for the last time we saw him, but I think that this last scene we can give him the big W, the big win, because he, like, sees his brother, and he goes and he hugs him. Like, no hard feelings. I love you, man. And Jacob's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this guy is hugging me. And he even says, sorry, I'm going to flip back, because I just thought this was so cool. He even says, because I have seen your face, I have seen your face, and it is like seeing God's face since you have accepted me. And maybe this is like a power play. Like, we talked a little bit about like Middle Eastern haggling, and this could have been a power play. But, you know, I just like the idea better that, you know, this is like personal growth on Esau's part.
And what we do see with Esau, he's the founder of the Edomites. And the Edomites are throughout Israel's history, they're okay. They're not terrible people like the Canaanites. And so we'll see a special relationship between the Israelites and the Edomites as they go forward. So he does kind of get the secondary blessing, you know. So
exactly.
And there is no love lost between the countries, which means there's probably no love lost. Or no, there is love between the brothers, so there's probably love between the countries. That's where I'm going.
All right, so back into chapter 37. Now we're going to talk about Joseph. Now 13 chapters are devoted to this guy, which means he's probably really important. A lot of people think that he's kind of like an early Christ figure. I really like Joseph because a lot of the people that we've seen so far, we don't really seem to like care about their personal character other than like them being in the Hall of Faith and being called righteous. But Joseph, he does seem to undergo some character development, which as a very literary society, we like it when our characters grow and change. There is a lot of parallel irony in this opening scene. We have Jacob, the father of Joseph, who dealt with not being the favorite son. He has a favorite son. So Jacob, he goes, I wasn't the favorite son. And there was direct consequences to that. And he goes, but I'm going to have a favorite son. And there's going to be lots of consequences. So, you know, maybe he didn't really learn his lesson there. So Israel, Jacob makes Joseph, who I've decided to call Joe in my notes. So if I say Joe, that's why. I also am a big fan of calling Bilhah and Zilpah, Billy and Zilly, but that's just me. I'm a big fan of nicknames. So if I say Joe, I'm talking about Joseph. So Israel makes Joseph a coat, which would have been a clear signal of his authority. And I read also may have been like Jacob like excusing him from work, like come learn how to be the best and don't go take care of the goats and stuff. And so he gets this really cool goat, and the text says that his brothers hated him for it and that they couldn't even speak amicably. That's some intense sibling rivalry. So we have a story that's about a lot of broken relationships and the eventual reconciliation of a lot of these relationships at the end. The text specifically also says that Joseph was kind of a snitch. So he's out with the sons of Billy and Zilly, which would have been all the middle children. And for you middle children out there, you know that that's a hard life being a middle child. So, and he brought a bad report about them to their father. And it says, now Israel loved Joseph more than the other sons because Joseph was a son born to him in his old age and made him a coat of many colors. So we already have some favoritism and Joseph not really doing anything to help himself here. So like I said, we have a pretty low platform from which to grow. So I think this is a story that reminds us that God is always present and that God is the great reconciler. So we are told that at 17, Joe starts having dreams. And we see that he once again does not help himself in his situation. And he goes and he brags to his brothers about his dreams. He's like, yeah, I had a dream that my sheath of wheat, yeah, you all bow down to it. High five, that's great. I'm going to roll over you. And his brothers are like, yikes, oh. And so the text says that they hate him even more. So then Joseph has another dream about planets this time. gets bow down to him, even the sun and the moon, like the mother and the father figure. And here we have Jacob coming over and being like, whoa. I'm your mother and I, we're going to bow down to you too. And when we were planning for class, Mitchell and Jay and I thought this was super ironic because Jacob had dreams from God that he took very seriously. So all of a sudden his son is having dreams and he's like, we're going to write this off because obviously you're not going to rule over me. So Jay, do you have any thoughts, comments, concerns? Okay, yeah, that's very concerning. So then we go... We continue down in chapter 37, and all... Oh, yes, Ambry.
So, when he shares his dreams, his father had seen how his mother responded to the dreams of the first time, and he was concerned, but it says that he was thinking of his wife, but like the way in his heart. But in scripture, it actually talks about how he feared for his son Joseph because of the way that his brothers were responding to it, and he was actually afraid for his wife.
Which is a well-placed fear, right? I mean, as the story progresses.
Yeah, and that, and okay, so that maybe even plays in a little bit to this next part. So we see that the brothers go to Shechem, right? And Joseph has to go check on them, right? So he didn't go with them. So maybe this is a play on Jacob's part to protect his son. Yeah, and so my question was like, why is Joseph going to check on the brothers? And then I was reading, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. They're at Shechem. Last time the boys were unattended at Shechem, they killed a bunch of people. So I think it's probably, like, maybe Jacob is like, yo, Joe, just make sure they didn't kill everyone again, because that was bad. That was bad last time. So,
and they come up with the idea to kill kill Joseph. You know, for the record, Reuben did not want to kill him or sell him. He was upset about it all. It was actually Judah's idea. Since we were talking about Judah being the line of the kings here, he was a little bit better than his brothers. He didn't want to kill him. He wanted to sell him.
Yeah.
So, maybe that's where we get the kingship coming from this line from. Is
exactly.
He's a little better than his other brothers.
Oh, I have more on that, too. I read some interesting theories. Interesting theories, guys. So, Joseph comes, and it says they see him, and they plot to kill him. And, like, being a millennial, I see this all, like, going down in a group chat. And, like, all the brothers are in this group chat, and they're like, hey, let's kill him. And then Reuben starts, like, his own other group chat, and he's like, let's not kill him. So that's how my millennial mind pictures this going down. So they plot to kill him. Reuben's like, no, we're not going to kill him. And so instead, he's like, let's just throw him in a pit, right? And Reuben's secretly thinking, okay, I'm going to go back and rescue him later and return him to my father. And my question is, like, why is Reuben doing this? Maybe it's because he's a good guy, but the text specifically indicates that he does some funny business with his aunt's sister mom. And I think that this is Reuben, like, trying to put himself back into good graces. Maybe it is the goodness of his heart. Usually I do like to assume the best in people, but I think that he's trying to make up for getting into some funny business with his aunt's sister mom. Yeah, so Reuben... It's aunt sister mom. So Reuben is like, no, we're not going to kill him. We're just going to throw him in this pit. And so they do that. And then Judah is like, hey, let's sell him, right? Like, what profit is it for us to kill our brother? Let's sell him into slavery. So I really do think that firstborn politics is really important here. So Reuben is the firstborn of Leah, and Joseph is the firstborn of Rachel, right? So I think that Reuben, you know, he's in bad graces with his dad. Levi and Simeon just killed a bunch of guys. They're in bad graces with his dad. So the next in line of Leah's sons would be Judah. So maybe Judah is like, let's not kill him because he's, you know, trying to collect some cosmic karma. And, you know, he's like, I didn't kill my brother. Please make me the firstborn God. I don't know. But I think that it's totally possible that this is like a power play on Judah's part to become the firstborn, like, you know, the inheritor.
To get the birthright.
Yeah, and this is also a theory of why chapter 38 is in the Bible in the first place. So we have all of this stuff about Joseph, and then all of a sudden chapter 38 comes up, and it's about Judah and Tamar? Question mark? What's that all about? And so obviously we know that David and Jesus come from this line of Judah, but that was an interesting theory, that that's why that chapter is in there. So firstborn politics, very important to man, not really that important to God. So now we're going to go over to, so they sell him into slavery, and 20 shekels is the going rate for a slave at that time. I really don't know how they're going to justify rolling back up into their father's house being like, we got 20 shekels, but no brother. I'd be like, where'd you get that 20 shekels, son? And they'd be like, oh, I don't know. We just, like, you know, sold some stuff. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So we jump over to chapter 39. Wow, that's really taking us back, guys. We're going forward, not backwards. And we see a really different person here. So the rest of our chapters with Joseph, we do see a lot of personal development. So we have him starting out at age 17, and we know that by the time his brothers get to Egypt, he's already 40 years old. So that's 23 years that go by. And I think the really amazing part, and we're not going to get into all of this text, because like I said, it's 13 chapters. We see Joseph being sold into slavery and into Potiphar's house, who's a really important official in Egypt, and he rises through the ranks in Potiphar's house. So it says specifically in verse 3 of 39, when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made everything he did successful, Joseph found favor with his master and became his personal attendant. And then it's skipping down, it once again says, the Lord blessed the Egyptian household because of Joseph. The Lord's blessing was on all that he owned and in his house and in his field. So we see God fulfilling his promise to bless these people wherever they go and bless people because of this, right? And then even after the whole Potiphar's wife situation goes down, obviously not ideal, Joseph gets thrown into prison. And even still, in verse 21, it says, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. He granted him with favor with the prison warden. And the warden put all of the prisoners who were in the prison under Joseph's authority, and he was responsible for everything that was done there. The warden did not bother with anything under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and the Lord made everything that he did successful. And then we continue with all of these dreams that people are having. Joseph interprets the dreams, and this eventually ends up with Joseph in the palace of Pharaoh, and he becomes the vicar, I think that's what it's called, the vizier, not the vicar, that's totally vizier. Different. The vizier of Egypt, and he's the second in command, and that's really cool. So everywhere Joseph goes, God blesses him.
And that sets up Joseph's revenge is what I'm calling it. Because I actually do think he's getting some revenge here. Let's look at what he does. He also fits right into this family, and he plants evidence, right?
Oh, wait, the brothers come to him first.
Yeah, the brothers come to him during a time of famine, and he sees them, and he has them in, and he puts their silver back in their bags. Commentators are kind of split. Is this a gift back to his family showing reconciliation? Or is this like setting them up as thieves for when he knows they're going to come back because he knows this famine is going on for 7 years. He, as part of the condition, if you come back again, you have to bring Benjamin. And now he's got them taking their silver back and they have to bring Benjamin. So both Reuben and Judah say that they will bring Benjamin back safely when they go on the second trip down. And sure enough, when Benjamin gets there, he puts the silver and a cup in Benjamin's bag. Presumably, Joseph knows that this will bring pain to both his father and to his brothers, that everyone is going to be pretty messed up about this. That's why I say this is Joseph's revenge. He's playing with them. He's doing the same thing that Jacob did before, and that whole family is pretty deceitful there.
Counterpoint to this, though, and you can decide. Like I said, I, though I have not seen the best in some of our characters, I'm going to choose to see the best in Joseph, mostly because he cries a lot. The text specifically says that he's overcome with emotion, and I think it says this on three different occasions.
Three
different occasions he weeps. So I want to believe that he went through some personal development and growth, but why does he put his brothers through all of these tests? Some suggest that it's because he's trying to see if he can trust them. So he specifically plants it on Benjamin, who would have been in the same position of potential jealousy as Joseph, to see if his brothers are going to be like, oh, yeah, Benjamin totally stole this. Take him. He's a rat. But we see that this is not the case.
And in fact, Judah says, hey, why don't you take me instead of Benjamin? I'll be your prisoner in Egypt. Let him go back. Of course, Joseph doesn't go for this, and Jacob ends up coming down, and he reveals himself, and they live happily ever after until Jacob dies. They bury Jacob in Canaan. They take him up there. And Joseph has his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, who are the two main tribes of the northern kingdom. Once we get to Judah and Israel later, the northern kingdom, Israel, is really these two tribes.
We have a question.
You're right. There is a lot of symbolism there. It's a beautiful thing that he does. Again, I have to wonder, because this is Reuben, who's been in the bad graces, if there might be some political motive. But that's just me looking at it in a new way this time. I've not thought of it that way before, and we're just trying to present lots of different viewpoints to think about things. So. Yeah, and that's the thing, too, is that, like, as we've said before, Genesis itself doesn't make any commentary on the hearts of these characters. Yeah, so we can kind of interpret that how we want. Like, you know, maybe these are all a series of really not good power plays, but maybe it's a series of, like, changes of heart, right? So I also read, too, that Joseph, like the Midrash, like the Jewish commentary on these stories, really believes that Joseph was a really great guy and that he was super righteous, right? And so they believe that Joseph, like, does all of this because he respects God and he wants to see the prophecies of God fulfilled. And so that's why he does all of this, so that his brothers will bow to him and that the prophecies will be fulfilled. And I think that this is very possible because Joseph clearly respects the visions that God gave him, and he obviously respects his faith, because even after living in Egypt for, like, decades at this point, he gives his kids Jewish names. Even though he's got an Egyptian wife.
Yeah, he has an Egyptian wife, Athenah, and he has an Egyptian name. What is it? It's like Zilpah, Zanapheth. Yeah, he has an Egyptian name with an Egyptian wife, but he still gives his kids Jewish names. And even when we are having this really touching, like, scene of, like, reuniting of the brothers, he even says that God did all of this so that he could protect the many in a famine. And this story, it really does, it seems to be a literary link between the rest of Genesis and how they got to Egypt, right? Which the Exodus, which we're about to get to next week, I think, right? Actually, no, I think in 2 weeks we're going to get to the actual Exodus. This is the crux of the Jewish story. The Jewish faith really revolves around, like, this whole Passover idea and leaving of Egypt. And so I think this is a story that shows that God was with us, guiding us and protecting us all the way to Egypt, and he will be with us, guiding us and protecting us out of Egypt into the land that he has promised. It's also a promise, affirmation, like a put your money where your mouth is, of this promise that they will be blessed wherever they go and that they'll be provided for wherever they go. As I said, Jay oftentimes reads these stories as the narrative of the Jewish people, and so we really see that here. I also really view this as the continuing revelation of God to people, right? And if you are coming onto the scene as I'm the highest God, the only God, and I have to show you that I'm different than other gods, I think this is how you do it. You show your caring provision, not just for groups of people, right? Because we see him caring for groups of people and providing in the famine, but also showing that he cares for individuals like Joseph, which would have been a very, in this day and age, ungodlike character. Gods typically only cared about themselves, but here we see our God caring about people and individuals, which I think is super significant.
I did want to mention what we'll call the historicity. The historicity just means, did this actually happen? And this is the first part where we can actually kind of talk about this at all, because we have some interesting things. So in Egypt, there's an early dynasty, then there are three kingdoms that are each followed by intermediate periods, and then there's a late period. So we're focusing here on the second intermediate period. This is usually dated around 1640 to 1532 BC. So this is kind of most people date Moses to between 1400 and 1450 BC, so this is a little bit earlier than that. And it's to put that into context, the pyramids at Giza had already been built for 1500 years. That's how old those are. And there's this period here in the second intermediate period where a group called the Hyksos were in charge of Egypt. And the Hyksos were a Semitic people, and they came to power from somewhere in Asia Minor. So this very well could have been Joseph and the Israelites coming into this area and having some power. At least during this period, a Semitic person like Joseph could come in and at least get power because they were at least open to that. The timing is a little bit wonky, but if Abraham is usually considered to be around 1750 BC, we're only talking about 110 years after Abraham. So it's just, it might work, it might not work in terms of historical timing. An interesting note here is that in the beginning of Exodus, we'll see that there's a new Pharaoh that did not know Joseph. That could just be the passage of time. It could also be that a new king 100 years or so later didn't know who an advisor was, especially when that was from a deposed line of kings. So that would have, this new king could be in this third kingdom is what they call it. Anyway, we have some Egyptian records, but they really did a good job of destroying the Hyksos records. They didn't want any mention of the Hyksos kings, and so it's kind of interesting that these records are missing. So we don't have anything that says anything about Joseph, son of Jacob, or Joseph, son of Israel, or Joseph the Hebrew. We don't have those, but we do have other names of some of the brothers and such in tablets and such that have appeared. So that either they're either common names or these same people potentially. There's also a thing called the Tomb of Joseph. This was in Shechem, that we've mentioned a couple of times already. That's in the modern-day West Bank. And that was opened several years ago by archaeologists, and it was found to have a body mummified in the Egyptian style, and it buried with it was a sword that was the type carried by Egyptian nobles. So it's kind of interesting that there's some things that say, hey, maybe this is a historical, factual story that we've been able to uncover, thousands of years later. And I wanted to talk about literary parallels because we've been real big on that. There is nothing like this story in the rest of the ancient world. This is a completely novel story to the Bible. There is nothing that compares to it. And I just wanted to point that out because we've pointed to how some other things could be influencing or whatever. But this is new and unique. So,
yeah, and this is the story so far. So we finished Genesis, and at the end of this, I have written down in my Bible, God is so kind, he is so generous, he always sees us, never forgets us, he is good, he is the Lord God Almighty, and he has shown his people who he is. And now he's going to go interact with them and rescue them from slavery.
Yeah, so, and we're going to go interact with people as they come into
church.
Yes,
excellent. All right.
Have a good one,
great
everyone.
Great class, guys.